Mr. Macmillan, Reel 10. The routine of the ship, other than outside of the action situation, the routine of the ship, did it change through war? Or did war change the routine in any way?
It didn't change the routine as far as the watches was concerned. The watches in the Royal Navy have been the same for generations. They always will be. It did change to a certain extent that it was no good saying we'll have dinner at 12 because you might be in the middle of an action. So you can more or less take things when the appropriate time arrived. But other than when you were in action or whatever, you must understand you've got cruising stations.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the various stations.
You have cruising stations, which cruising stations, you may have a couple of torpedo men. But no matter what stations are, you always have lookouts. The engine room and stokers, I don't know a great deal about, so I won't get into that. You always have a B-gun. B-gun is always manned. Irrespective of what's happening, B-gun's always manned. For the simple reason, you can speak to it over the bridge. And in an emergency, you can shout, B-gun, train on, while the rest of the guns get closed up. Cruising stations, you've probably closed up half your armament. Action station, everybody. Every gun, everyone went at action stations. But you were allocated these stations by the coxswain when you joined the ship. Your cruising station on B gun may not have been your action station when it comes to the push. But the B gun always closed, always, night and day when you were at sea. That gun was always closed up. As I said before, you get some funny remarks coming from them, believe you me. And the language is out of this world if somebody kicks up. You would have to be there to hear it, to believe it. And then it would go quiet and they would start singing little songs. You've no idea how it used to buck the morale up. You know,
Did they ask you to sign a will on the outbreak of war? Or make out your will?
No. The only thing is, as I said before, on my history sheet that you get when you join, they ask you your next of kin. Now, my next of kin remained my mother throughout the war, although I had married in then, and I had changed me. You must understand, sailors, one day you're here, one day you're there, one day you're there. They can't keep your history sheet really. I mean, on my history sheet, I'm only down there as a leading signalman. And various things, they were never fetched up to date because you could be any damn where. Now, that was the only thing next of kin. My mother's name and my mother's address, and they changed houses, I would think, 4 times during the war, but I've still got the original address on, so that was never brought up to date either. I don't remember signing anything about secrets or anything like that at all, to be honest with you.
In the war situation, again, sailing in whatever, out of action and in action, was there a great deal of rivalry between destroyers that knew each other?
Oh, yes. Even in peacetime, if you could watch some destroyer and she was doing something, you thought, now if she's polishing there, we'll polish here. Because wartime, there's no polish. It's all grey. Everything's painted over grey. Or camouflage, whatever you mean. And as, you might watch some. No, he's hoisting his signals this way, but I know a better way. You know, you pick up little tips and things like that, you know. Now, they got the whaler hoisted in 2 minutes. We'll try and do it in a minute and a half. And 9 times out of 10, the damn thing fell back in the water again. But there were some comical things. You had your football matches in peacetime, water polo, rugby, boxing. Because you'd still had them during the war, but not as often, obviously. Oh, there was great rivalry. Who can keep the ship the cleanest then? Oh, you might not believe me, but in times of peace before the war started, our flag deck, where we had the flag lockers, we used to cherry blossom it, black polish. It was that courtesine, which is non-slip. And our chief yeoman would have a black polish and buff it up for inspections. Oh, very, very strict like that in peacetime. It done you good because it learned your responsibility, which come in very good for you when we eventually went into hostilities.
After the Norway situation, because what's wrong with the Norway situation? Those were the colder waters. If you were on duty on the the deck or the bridge, what clothing did you wear?
All lookouts and signalmen get watch coats, big black watch coats. I shall show you a photograph of one later on. And underneath as much as you could get. Maybe a sou'wester, a towel to stop the water going down your neck. And these watch coats used to come right to your damned ankles. And they were good. They kept you warm. There wasn't a great deal laid down on dressing up uniform-wise when you went to sea. It was more for comfort. And Norway was quite cold, but we'll come to another part in the Arctic after that, which was colder still. Norwegian campaign only lasted, 3 or 4 months? To the best of my knowledge. And then...
You recall no particular event in that where you were heavily involved, other than landing troops, which you've mentioned?
Well, that was the most heavily involved thing that we'd done, was landing the troops. And then coming out and patrolling off the fjords for these invisible German ships again that we never seen, you know. And
how was that done? Were you allocated a certain area of sea on the map which you had to traverse? And
well, what shall we say?
Like a grid system.
You would get a signal, patrol the mouth of Rombach Fjord. That's one of the, I think that's one of them. And you just got, there might be two of you. And you would up and down all the time. We never found out what for yet. But went up and down. And then maybe after about a few hours, you would find another couple of stores. They would take them and give you a rest to do something else. But destroyer life is very varied. You can be asked to do the most unusual things. But it was mostly transporting troops. I can remember the early days in Norway.
Was there a rapport between the sailor and the soldier when you had them on board? Get close together?
No, I wouldn't say that, because sometimes they may only have been aboard an hour. And you felt sorry for them. Because, I mean, the ship, they wouldn't be used to a ship bucking in that way. We could walk on it, practically walk on it any time, no matter which way. You got your body got used to swaying, not with the ship, against it, so that you kept your upright. But the soldiers with the packs and the tin hats and the khaki uniforms and the big heavy boots, we really did feel sorry for them. But we used to try and get them to huddle around the funnels. That was the warmest part, and it was out the way of all the guns. Because they wouldn't understand that if a gun come round, it might clobber them on the head or something. So we used to try and keep them in what you would call the waist of the ship. That was done with the two...
How many would you Say, how many would you carry on?
200 or 300. And another thing we used to do, and this is rather, if we come back and we went to Iceland, the destroyers could go into Reykjavik Harbour, but I don't think the big ships, they used to go around to Val, some of that. And we used to go around and pick a couple of hundred sailors off the big ships, take them around to Reykjavik so they could do a bit of shopping, and then bring them back at night time. Even they were not used to the pitching of a destroyer, because they were on more solid battleships, etc. That was, you see, that's another job for a destroyer. And then before that, we went to Iceland to take over...
Just before we come to that, just to finish off the Norwegian campaign, when you were picking troops up to bring them off, were you under fire then, because they would be evacuating?
You could be under fire any time. Not from the land, more from aircraft dropping bombs. I think the troops were more demoralised by the situation ashore. I think they were glad to get onto a ship to go onto the troop ship. Now, you've got to imagine these chaps coming back, and some of them are in a hell of a state, going onto the destroyer, shooting down the fjord to where the troop ships were, and then have to clamber up onto a troop ship, because a troop ship... maybe 30 or 40 feet that to climb. I mean, it's not very nice when you've got maybe a rifle and all your kit. We never had that trouble about carrying kit around. It was all kept with us, you know. So that was more or less...
After Norway, was Iceland always a naval base for the Navy?
No, we more or less had to take it over. We went up there, two or three destroyers with a couple of cruisers. There were reports that maybe German ships in Reykjavik. As it turned out, there wasn't. There was only a couple of Icelandic naval ships. What they were to this day, I don't know. But everything was settled very friendly. They didn't like us. And as you know, in the end... all British troops were withdrawn, and it was taken over completely by Americans. Because I believe Iceland is Danish, isn't it?
Possibly, I don't know, quite honestly.
Is it Danish like the Faroe Islands? It's not a British colony. But it was very handy for one thing. We could buy nylon stockings and bring them home to our girlfriends. And buy things like that, but they wouldn't distinguish the lights because it was a neutral country, you see. So we didn't, as I say, they didn't like us, but they tolerated us. You might not believe this, but when we went in there the second time, there was actually Americans on holiday in Iceland. You were coming for the fishing and the geysers and whatnot. They were actually on holiday. So, but when the Americans took over, you see, the mighty dollar, money, they would be welcome because they had the money, you see. No, and
in what way did they show the fact that they weren't keen on the British there?
They sort of just ignored you.
You would get ashore, no doubt.
Well, you could get ashore, but once you got ashore and you got your silk stockings, etc., nylon stockings and that, you didn't bother going back again. It was a very poor anchorage place as well, which, of course, you must understand, Norway is a hell of an anchorage place with a deep fjord. You couldn't anchor. You had to more like, if you did get an anchor down, you had to keep your engines going to keep you properly on station. I never did like Iceland. No, I don't know. It turned out to be a hell of a good staging post for convoys, eventually. But I never liked Iceland, and I'd only went ashore a few times. I think you'll find if you ever talk to sailors, that destroyer men are not great going ashore people. I don't know why. I think they preferred to stop on board and...
Finally, just before we leave Norway, did you ever get close to some other ship that was damaged or sunk during the operations?
No. Not what you see close. We have seen them hit. But there's not much you can do about it. You could go alongside and take off survivors, but we never had done that. Not on the Mashona, I must admit. No. We've seen a couple of destroyers hit and damaged. The Afridi, the French one called, I think it was the Bison. The Gurkha, she was sunk out there. And I believe the Mohawk was hit. One or two troop ships.
Seeing a ship hit, what is it, the feeling of sympathy or anger?
I don't think it's sympathy or anger. I think it's in your mind that that could have been you. You know, there, but for the grace of God, go I, sort of thing. You didn't like it, but later on, we come to the conclusion that we thought more of the merchant seamen on board them ships than we did of anything else. That was, I think that was... We set out later on when we were doing Russian convoys. We thought more of the merchant seamen. We never thought of the ships, but we thought of the merchant seamen, which even today I think that was the bravest service in the world. Even above the Royal Navy was the men of the merchant navy. I'll always admit that. Anger? I suppose if an aircraft did come over, you did get a bit of anger out your body. Sympathy? I think you've seen so much of it that it didn't affect you in the end.
So, after Norway, which was around about April 1940, was just before Dunkirk, Norway, where did you get involved then?
Well, it was back to Scapa Flow, repairs, because... destroyers are always getting repairs because they do some high-speed stuff and rough weather and whatnot. Then we're in Scapa Flow, and that's when one night, we got the order to wait to escort whatever it may be, hunting the rabble, some German ship or other. And through a mistake in the, not the signal department, through the mistake in the organisation, the destroyers did not know which gate to go out. With the result, as we were going down the fjord, lo and behold, there was a Sikh right in front of us. And we rammed into her. Now this is where I explain to you later on. I walked from my ship to the Sikh. And I met the gentleman who, I told you, later on married my cousin. I had never seen him since the wildfire. And I went and shook him in his hammock. The next day they pulled us apart. And we went into the floating dock in Scapa Flow. And we got a bit like iron come cement bows put on. And we come down to, I think it was Gray's in Immingham. To get repaired.
And during repairs, did you get the chance to go and leave?
Oh yes, you got 10 days, providing, or that the ship was going to be in. Sometimes it was only a weekend leave. I think we were in Immingham for about 3 or 4 weeks. So each watch got leave. You always keep half your watch on board, you know. That was quite enjoyable because we had one of my friends come from Grimsby, which isn't far away, is it, from Birmingham? So we used to go up to his house, and well, there was four of us. We were together for, about 3 of us were together for 4 years, and the other one 2 years. The other one was when I was home on leave once. I was home on survivor's leave after the Machona was sunk, and he was coming up the picture on. I was taking my cousin, who married Fred Walters from the Sikh, and I says, "Hello, Norman, I've been at school with him." He says, he was in the Navy. I says, "Where are you going?" He says, "Oh," he says, "I'm going down to Swan Hunter to join the Ashanti." I says, "You're joking." He says, "No." He says, "Why?" He says, "Well," I says, "I'm on border." So we met, and I was with him for another, for 2 years. But two telegraphers, I was with a lad from Sunderland and a lad from Grimsby. I was with them for just over 4 years. We come right through from peacetime, right through to 1943 when we come home.
After repairs, where did you go?
As usual, back to Scapa Flow. Everything went into Scapa Flow. Except if there was any submarine scares, we might come down to Loch Ewe, which is in the west coast of Scotland. But it was mostly Scapa Flow, which you must understand is a damn dismal place. There was only the cinema ashore, the canteen ashore, which other than that, there wasn't much life. It was all sheep. So that I think we preferred to stay on board and make our own. We used to have sods operas where lads would go up and give a bit of song, and we had our own little cinema. But every so often you had to stop it and change the reels round. It wasn't continuous, you know. It was the old-fashioned big thing. And then we once got a film on board, and they called it The Voyage of the Ashanti, when she went down to Takoradi in the west coast of Africa, just before the war broke out. And of course, when it come on, they were shouting, "Oh, stop it!" And they were going up, and they were, "Hey, look, there's old so-and-so on the screen." Well, that was comical. And then we had the game of bingo, which is legal in the Royal Navy, the only gambling game that was legal then. I think you paid sixpence for a card. It went into the canteen funds to buy little odds and ends, you know. That was our entertainment. But you didn't want much entertainment, because after you'd been at sea, we'll say, 10 days, you were ready to come back, have a good shower, maybe a haircut, tidy your kit, dry it out. That was the most important thing. And you didn't know within 24 hours you could be away again.
Again, in general terms, being fit, healthy young men, how did you cope with the lack of female companionship? Not seeing them for probably quite a while.
I don't think it... This is another episode which... I don't know whether we're going to talk about this or whether you're going to finish today or not. I don't know. But this is another episode that come up when we're on the Ashanti, which was at Wall's End when we joined her. Now, of all the 2.5 years I was on board that ship, or even the Machona for that matter, I had never heard of any sailor being in trouble with girls, because the Ashanti was a boozer ship. And when I say a boozer ship, it was. They were noted. They would go ashore, girls didn't enter the mine, it was all beer. Oh, they were a real boozing crew. You believe you me, I had never seen anything like it. I got into the habit of it myself. That's all we thought of, was drink. I can't see girls, I suppose they were their interests, but... you could get home, I would imagine, at the least a 24-hour leave or a weekend leave every 3 months, we'll see. Because the Distog isn't quite regular for boiler clean, you know, with having high speeds all the time, etc., you know, and getting buffed about and rivets popping out. And as the war progressed, getting new equipment on board and getting your funnels cut down to lower your silhouette, and your main mast was taken off and the little goalpost mast was up, and our pom-pom was situated behind the two funnels, just in forward of the searchlight, that the pom-pom could cover an arc right over. But the only thing wrong with it is, when the aircraft come over and the pom-pom, the big, you know, the what they call the Chicago piano, the big, it's a big two-pounder with four barrels. When it swung down to follow the aircraft, it always shot until it were wireless aerials down. Always. I've got photographs of the wireless aerials training. Well, they all had to be re-rigged when we come in. It was noted for that. I'm sure they didn't know what they were shooting at half time, but never mind. So, and then flags had to be dried out. Ship, you can imagine what the, especially the funnels, with the heat and the salt water, they were grey. And you would go, what you would get into dock, and when you come back, you have found you were camouflaged black. And then you maybe 6 months later, when you went leaving, you come back, and you were all white for the Arctic, you know. Then, of course, you had to paint ship yourself at times to keep. But most of the time was oiling, ammunition, food, keeping your ship clean, keeping yourself clean. That occupied most of your time when you come back into harbour.
Sensitive question, but were there one or two crewmen who had homosexual tendencies?
Well, I have heard of it. I never come across any, but if there were any, I can assure you they'd done the job as their job. What they'd done in their own life didn't concern. I mean, there were certain people say, oh, you're oh, look at that puff, or something like that. But that was a slang. No, I honestly do not remember any. They could have been there, they could have been my messmates, I do not know. But I had never heard of anyone encouraging it or mentioning it. No, not on. If that had been known on a small ship, I don't think they would have lasted very long. On large ships, where you have a lot of time sitting in harbour, I don't know. I never come across one. Stories, yes, but proof, no.
What you're saying is life on a destroyer was pretty hectic, pretty.
It was hectic.
Time.
You had enough things to do without worrying about those sort of things, by keeping the ship, yourself, and all that clean. Because you never got a great deal of harbour time.